Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Sunday Show of Here Be Monsters. I'm Gwendolyn H. Berry. I'm down here in South Florida today. And Jack Jodell has the flu, but he'll be back with us next week. Two things. Congratulations to our friends at Soul Fire for the Golf, Dr. John Mizumani's Turtle Woman Rising, and the six of the Indigenous Grandmothers Council and the Nations for their very successful water ceremonies this week in Mandeville and New Orleans, and all of us who satellited all around the world and all around the United States this ceremony on Friday. Today, it's the Earth Day weekend, and we've made our stand for the Earth Mother. I also wanted to mention something else. This is just a Gwen thing here, folks, but I did read, and of course I heard it over the television this morning, but Philip Humbert tossed what they call a perfect game for the Chicago White Sox, and they defeated the Seattle Mariners 4-0 yesterday at Safeco Field. I am told that perfect game is a lot different than a no-hitter, and I'm not going into it, but there's only been about 27, so kudos to the White Sox, the Chicago White Sox. That's not the Red Sox, folks. That's the White Sox. And today, after the interview, we're going to do some Earth Day news rundown and take calls for discussion. That would be around 7 p.m. for those of you who don't go over to Rick Spezak's Progressive News Network showing. Okay, another thing, too. May Day's coming. It's a global general strike. Remember, stay home, spend quality time with the family and home, occupy Mother Nature on that day. Or better yet, do the May Day thing with the Occupy group, go down and march the devil with NDAA. This is Here Be Monsters, and we're sponsored by Roundtree7.com, Knowledge to the Social Consciousness. And in a minute, guest is a gentleman named Bruce Shuttleworth. He's a progressive Democratic candidate for Congress in Northern Virginia. And his bio reads like my favorite Clancy hero, Jack Ryan. He's a naval pilot, retired. He's a graduate of Annapolis and did some time over at West Point, too. He'll explain that. And he's a graduate of Harvard Business School. A qualified man in every traditional way who has been fighting for his place to run a progressive campaign for Congress, now this is Congress, against the corporate machine of the Democrat incumbent. And of course, you know, I'm using my words there, corporate machine. Bruce, you've been so patient. Thank you. Are you with me?
I sure am. Thanks for having me, Gwen.
My pleasure. You just explained to me you did a term also when you were going to school at Annapolis over at West Point, and you graduated though from Annapolis. Yes,
that's right. But in terms of the West Point connection, the service academies pick six midshipmen or cadets to exchange to the sister service academies to represent themselves there, and to try to see what the other side might do better or might do worse, and then to pass that learning on. So it's a terrific opportunity to see how the other side does it. I am very proud of being able to speak a little bit of Army, and I am very grateful for the time I had there, and I consider myself to be certainly a part of the long gray line.
Oh, that's saying a lot, too. I understand. First off the bat, I want to ask you to tell me why you are a progressive Democratic candidate?
Sure. Well, I'm going to fight for all the progressive values that are important to progressives, like clean energy and economic and social justice and a family doctor for all, and then discrimination in really any form. And one of the key moments in my life not too long ago, unfortunately, was when my parents were both diagnosed with lung cancer as non-smokers. And statistically, it's about a 1 in a million shot. And I got to see up close and personal what happens in our healthcare system, and most especially the importance of clean air, which I see as a matter of life and death.
So, if your position right now on the fight that is going on for the Environmental Protection Agency, how do you see that? In what terms do you see it? I mean, it's from my point of view, it's couched corporatism, but to get rid of it. But how do you see it, Bruce?
Well, I think we have to emphasize a clean environment above all else. I mean, it really comes down to being a life or death issue. I think it's a basic human right, and we have to do everything we can to make sure that we the government provides a very strong counterpunch, if you will, to any corporate interests that might not be as concerned with maintaining the environment as they should be.
Well, as I understand the need for political compromise when boy, that word came out hard, didn't it? this is why I'm on the radio.
I thought it was quite articulate, but go ahead.
But the very, very honest nature of it is that there's political compromise, but the compromising has just totally fallen off the cliff to most of America right now. People are, and we were speaking earlier about this, and perhaps you might, as the candidate, address this. People are apathetic. People are afraid of what's going to happen next. A lot of folks who, it's not so hard anymore for people to be informed because we have this thing called the Internet, where people get on and they find out that people are in the streets of Athens and Lisbon and Dublin, and the IMF is imposing austerity programs. Over here, though, Bruce, what we're being told is that, things are progressively getting better, and the uphill climb is certainly there, but nothing like what is happening to the countries over there is about to touch us, which is, for people looking at it, it's, to me, I'll just put it in my own terms, to me it's very frightening, and I'm wondering, it's frightening to me, in other words, that our government is telling us that austerity measures like we're seeing over there, they're not addressing that at all. They're just, having this fight between Democrat and Republican social program values. You see where I'm going, Bruce? I'm wondering, how do you see this whole issue? And I know it's a large question to ask, so please go where you need to go to answer it and talk about being Congressman Shuttleworth about it,
Well, I think that, it's a highly polarizing issue, and, it's been made more polarizing by how the parties tend to tack, to the extremes to some degree during the primary, contest. And we see that across the country, and it makes for a much more hollow center, I think, in our government. And we need to have people that are strong enough in government that can make principled compromise. I think it takes more backbone to be able to, talk to the other side and to figure out, where you can come together on certain things that are reasonable. But there's certain things that you can't compromise on, and you can never compromise on sacrificing, people's prospects for living a, full and happy and engaged life. Those are the kind of things that progressives, can never back down on and should never back down on. That's a fight that we have to win, and it's a fight that we will win if we, have the proper priorities in place. Most assuredly, there can be some conflict with corporate interests, corporations are incredibly important. I get that. I'm a Harvard Business School guy, as you mentioned. Don't hold that against me. Also a strategy management consultant. You know, I get the power of free markets. I know how important it is. But they have to be in balance with a strong, smart, effective government that can counter, you know, that bully of big money, if you will, that, you know, has, you know, one clear interest, and that is their special interest. And I don't begrudge special interests for doing what they do, which is representing their special interests, just by definition. What I have a huge beef with, Gwen, are congressmen that don't keep those special interests at arm's length, that embrace those conflicts of interest and take in huge campaign contributions and then has that color their vote.
You had, I have about four questions out of that, but one thing I do want to get to here that brought actually my attention to, into your direction was the problems you had getting yourself on the ballot. Could you address that? Could you talk to my audience about what you've gone through to fight your way to the ballot on this election?
Absolutely. You know, I anticipated having to fight a bit of an uphill battle against the incumbent, but I certainly didn't expect to have to fight against sort of the inner machinery of the Democratic Party around here. So what happened, Gwen, is that our campaign, I think quite responsibly, had dozens of volunteers, and we turned in 1,823 petition signatures. And I'm not sure if you all know, but for running for Congress, you need to turn in 1,000. So we thought we were going to be absolutely fine. So I was shocked, I say, to, with 15 minutes to go before the certification deadline, I received a phone call on voicemail, and it said that we only had 983 valid signatures. That was a bad moment and very surprising. In fact, that was probably the worst moment of my life that was non-healthcare related.
I can imagine.
It was just horrible. You know, how could that happen? So my team and I got together, and we talked about this, and we quite frankly decided, well, it couldn't happen, that something is wrong here. So we called up and said, hey, can we please see our petition sheets? We'd like to check them out ourselves. Something seems to be a bit askew here. So it took like 3 days for them to get these sheets to us. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking, and within 45 days of the primary, the State Board of Elections has to print the absentee ballots, and you only have so much time to appeal. And we looked at what our options were as we were looking through these petition sheets. And, well, lo and behold, we saw that not all of our petition sheets were returned to us. There were dozens missing. So we called up and said, hey, where are the rest of our petition sheets? They're missing. And the 8th Congressional District Democratic Committee went dark on us, and they wouldn't return our emails or answer our phone calls. And that was a bad sign. So we had two options. One was to appeal the Democratic Party of Virginia, which is a 10-day process, and we didn't think we had too much of a chance with that, or we could involve our legal system. And I want you to know that it's tough to have to sue the Democratic Party of Virginia in federal district court when you're running as a Democratic candidate for Congress. And it's also tough financially because that is personal money that I had to spend that my children will never see, and it was five figures worth. Very non-trivial. And at any rate, it's amazing, Gwen, just how motivating it can be, I guess, to an organization when they have a federal lawsuit that they're facing. So it would appear that that provided the extra motivation for them to look just a little bit harder for those missing petition sheets. And lo and behold, I get a call from my lawyers within 24 hours of that lawsuit being dropped in their laps, and they found those missing petition sheets. And they said to my lawyers that we will now put Bruce Shuttleworth on the ballot, and we'll just go forward from here without any apology, without any offer to defray the legal costs, and with no explanation of how this happened. It's really frightening how for 1 second in the United States of America, in the shadow of the Capitol here, you could lose petition sheets for a candidate for United States Congress. It is something that everyone should be very frightened about, and I'm concerned this happens across the country in other areas as well. Lack of confidence It's astounding.
I'm from South Florida. I'm from the state of Florida, Bruce.
Gotcha.
And this does not shock me. I'm from the Jeb Bush state. I'm from the state where hanging chads became an issue.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't surprise me. But let me ask you a question. Has this risen your star at all in the primary election? Have people begun to understand who you are? What has it done for your campaign?
Well, a lot of people around here are shocked. It is something that most people had no idea could possibly happen. It seems to be a bit of a weak link in the Democratic chain where one person can have such incredible power in terms of telling the State Board of Elections, you know, who is certified and who is not. And, you know, when I put it in the perspective of, you know, in your wildest dreams, you know, could you ever imagine the incumbent's petition sheets being misplaced and the incumbent not making it onto the ballot? Most assuredly, the answer to that is no, not in our wildest dreams. And it really does get at, you know, some serious, serious issues around this. And people don't take gross negligence or worse very well in this area. And so a lot of people are even more interested than they were ordinarily about me challenging Jim Moran. And people want answers, and they want to know, you know, how could, you know, there be no due process and no right of review. So it's definitely had the profile raised, and people are quite sympathetic to the campaign, more so than they were even before.
Well, this brings up the question, too. It just leads into another national issue, which I'd really like to know how you think this is the point of corporate personhood and what the Supreme Court has done to elections in general for this election season. How do you find... do you think this makes any bearing on what's going on in Northern Virginia at all and what you've faced? Your pockets are clean from your own account, but the Supreme Court has made it possible for people to be supplied by corporations en masse, and I'm wondering where you stand on all of this.
Right, yeah, you know, absolutely. I get that corporations are important, but it most assuredly has to be, you know, we the people, not we the corporations. I agree, you know, with the Amend Now crowd with where they're going there. It's interesting, and looking through the Citizens United ruling a few months back, I recall Justice Stevens concluded in his minority dissent something along the lines of, you know, while American democracy is not perfect, few outside the majority of this court would have thought its flaws included a dearth of corporate money in politics. And, you know, that is so true. But that said, we are all about freedom of speech. And, you know, I think these conversations are going to be broad and wide and deep. And, you know, we're always going to have special interests, and I don't begrudge them. But I have a huge bone to pick with our Congress that folds like a deck chair in the face of you know, these campaign contributing special interests. It's, again, their job to make sure that they keep these at arm's length so they can make the, you know, right kind of decisions. But most assuredly, in terms of super PACs coming in with huge money and a lack of transparency, it's really disconcerting. And, you know, I...
unfair. It's really unfair. What it does is it allows the corporations to actually choose the candidates and to supply us with – it's a supply-side government now. My jaw dropped incredibly. With the rest of the thinking country on this one, I'm wondering if you would also at the same time, as long as we're talking about huge amounts of money, I noticed on your site that one of the things as a progressive, that one of the issues you, as a progressive and as retired military, that you are looking to address is the spending on military right now at this time. Please elaborate what your point and position is on military spending and just reducing the military spending that we've got going on at the moment. That's overwhelming in sight of everything else that we're facing on a domestic level.
All right, sure thing. So, our current defense budget is about $929 billion a year, which is more than the next 20 countries' defense budget rolled into one, and that includes so many of our allies. And that tells me that there is a lot of room to trim that defense budget down without compromising our national defense. I think one of the issues we have right now is that our primary tool seems to be a hammer. And when your primary tool is a hammer, a lot of issues start to look like nails. And I don't know what it is about so many of these Republican chicken hawks out there that never served their country, and they see this hammer and they have this reflexive, strong grip on it, and the way they want to go around banging nails is almost Pavlovian in nature.
So basically, my question would be to you is, when we're spending over half of income tax money on military, when our water and our environment and all of these issues, and Bruce, to be honest with you, I'm one of those for the earth completely and holistically kind of a voter, and not kind of a voter, and
right.
I'm going to ask you, tell me, how would you take funds away from what is definitely not working out for us now? And I'm thinking you're going to explain to me how you see it from a international point of view and as a military man. But what would you do different from that perspective in the face of global environmental devastation, and especially here at home and in the South? And I started this show because I was so upset because the truth was not being told about the Gulf oil spill and the devastation there, which is ongoing and very horrible. And
right.
I'd like to know, where you're coming from that perspective, and with the funding and the money and how it gets spent.
Right. So, well, in terms of defense spending cuts, I think that we're going to have to focus on future wars, not the past wars. And there's a lot more opportunity to cut a lot of the traditional fighting forces. I think that we're going to need to probably invest more in cybersecurity and in asymmetrical warfare and special operations and in areas that we've really come a long way. Certainly, our drone capability is changing the way we conduct a lot of warfare, which also does give rise to a lot of other issues that we could address later in terms of, perhaps it's too easy to go to war when you're using drones and not pilots over countries. But we can discuss that in a little bit. But certainly I think there's a lot of room for good military cuts that, quite frankly, the military would embrace as well. And I think I have a lot of credibility that I can bring to bear in those discussions, having gone to the Naval Academy in West Point and been a fighter pilot. I get where the military is effective, and I get where we can have cuts. But above and beyond that, I also get the hardship of war and how the military suffers the most at the tip of the spear when you have these incredibly long deployments in incredibly unsafe areas and so many people don't come home. I get that very much.
We have 18 vets a day who commit suicide in this country. It breaks your heart. You don't understand those kind of numbers. But we aren't going to agree on that one. But in the midst of I'm going here, we have supposedly the most advanced military systems, but our country's infrastructure is crumbling, and it's not balancing out. And the drone warfare that we've begun to conduct hasn't it been a diplomatic horror show, really?
Has it been strategically
successful for us, Bruce?
Well, you know, on the drone warfare, I think we actually might agree, because I think that it is becoming too easy to go to war with drones, and it should be more difficult to commit hostile acts against other countries. I think that Congress weighs in very aggressively whenever we have our servicemen put at risk. But if the president decides to use drones instead, they're kind of okay with that. And it puts the United States' reputation at great risk when, you know, if you make mistakes in these foreign countries, people have long memories. And people don't take too kindly to having, you know, the tip of a gun or the point of a gun or certainly missiles coming off of drones. And you have casualties that come from that you do not put the United States military in good stead, and it doesn't put the United States government in good stead many times. I think we need to be much more cautious when it comes to committing these acts of war. That said, I'm sure that President Obama means very well when it comes to national security before he commits you know, these acts of hostility. And certainly there's a time and place that makes sense for it. But it is a concern that Congress chooses to intervene more substantially when American servicemen are at risk, and they don't do nearly as much when drones are. And I think we need to come to a better strategic rationale of when and how we use drone warfare.
Well, I have a question for you, especially as Congressman Shuttleworth. What's going to happen the first time that a foreign country flies a drone into our airspace?
Yeah, well, that's going to be a concern, and I think that timeline might have been escalated by the drone that went down in Iran. Who knows where that technology...
Yes, I saw that. I hear what you're saying there. I just on a personal side here to show you, everyday Joe under the leadership here, the U.S. citizen, who has forged through these social networks friendships and relationships with people. I mean, I've got friends, Bruce, in Iran. I've got a very, very good friend in Pakistan, whose neighbor, three houses down, was taken out by one of our drones. There were children in that house. She doesn't see me as the enemy, but she certainly sees my leadership as the enemy, much as I see her leadership as troublesome. I think that social networks and the relationships we're forging out here have a lot to do with how government is going to evolve, if you will, in the next, even during this campaign to a certain degree. And I'm wondering what kind of a knowledge that you might bring to it or use it for in your own candidacy, and if you are elected, how you see that making a difference. Because and I'm going to the Occupy group, and I'm going to ask you about that in this question, Bruce. It is a global movement, and it started with, you know, the poor young man in Tunisia, Mohamed Bouazizi, who self-immolated. And then it went into the Egyptian spring, and everybody's waiting for May Day here. Do you follow where I'm going? Can you address that? I know it's a lot, but...
Well, I certainly agree that social media is making an enormous difference in geopolitics, and the Arab Spring might not have turned out as it has so far without it. In fact, it most assuredly would not have. And certainly it's playing a role in Syria right now and all countries in the world. And you could even go a little bit further and say that the world's a safer place, you know, from just people being able to have a cell phone, being able to take a picture and to immediately, you know, spread that to the entire world, basically. It has such an ameliorative effect in so many ways, and it gives me a great deal of optimism to know that the people's will can be so rapidly communicated, and it's a great counterbalance to a lot of dictatorial governments and bad actors across the world. So kudos to social media and the impact that it's having and will continue to have. It's going to be breathtaking to see how this spreads even more over time and how people manage, you know, this information and the video that they can show of atrocities being committed in any way and how good forces can rally to hopefully address that.
Well, it brings to bear the movements that have been coalesced together. I mentioned as we were coming into this, the global general strike that's been called by the Occupy groups, which I will be taking part in as a little business maker and, you know, within my little group here. But I'm wondering, what do you make of Occupy and Occupy Wall Street and the reasons for it and addressing the great inequality and what most people see as injustice of banking in the world today abroad? I mean, look at the IMF and look at the Fed, and folks are in the streets, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think Occupy is playing just a critical role, you know, in focusing rightful attention on just the incredible unfairness that's been going on, you know, to if not the 99%, then some seriously high percentage for way too long in our society. The lack of social and economic justice, in the United States and the world is really jarring. As I said before, I'm a business school guy, and I do get the power of free markets and how important they are. But I know that we need a smart, strong, effective government to provide a critically needed counterbalance to that bully of big corporate money that you see everywhere. And again, I'd point out that it's easy to blame the special interests, and we should, for being just so incredibly selfish on so many fronts, especially around the economic undoing of the last 5 years. But we need to blame Congress every bit as much and probably more so for being so weak-kneed before them.
Agreed. That and also the president. You're a military man, and I'd like to have your opinion. We were discussing earlier your opinion on the changes in military, especially as to issue of the gay, lesbian, I'm trying to get it right, transgender, bisexual community. And in that, I would also ask you the question about, as far as the military, when you do answer that question, would you also segue into what you might think of, what your opinion is of Bradley Manning and his whistleblowing?
Right. So when I was at the Naval Academy, I roomed with more than one gay midshipman, and so I know what a dishonest disgrace Don't Ask, Don't Tell was, and what a blow to national security it was to remove people from the military that are willing to risk their lives on our behalf. It's just an outrage. It's just a ridiculous outrage. And I'm happy to say that the next domino to fall is going to be, the Defense of Marriage Act, which, of course, there's no defense for. I wish that we could just treat everyone the same and not infringe upon their rights and be able to focus on, the issues of our day that are more contentious. And, it's just amazing what a distraction these ridiculous policies are. Let's just not infringe upon anyone's rights and move on. I don't know if that answered your question enough in terms of my feeling on.
I was looking for your position as a candidate on Don't Ask, Don't Tell being gone and the gay rights issues, and I think you're pretty clear on that.
Well, let's talk just a hair more on that. I mean, it's embarrassing that the military took so long to embrace gays in the military when clearly they've been serving the military for since the beginning of time. And to have people in a service that certainly embraces the concept of honor and integrity to have a policy like don't ask, don't tell, I mean, that is a dishonest policy. That is no way to go about your business. And, you know, I was embarrassed by that policy for so long, and I'm delighted to see it fall. I'm sorry that we didn't spearhead that like we did with integration of African Americans into our organization. And not that the military was 100% perfect on that one. They most assuredly were not. But I think they had a bit of a leadership role in promoting African Americans and assimilating them in a better way than in some other areas of society. They certainly should have done a much better job, and it's embarrassing it took as long in the military as it did for that. But with gays in the military, you know, I'm talking to folks that are in the military now, and just like we thought, you know, no big deal. These folks have been serving side by side since the beginning of the time, getting it done, and it's just ludicrous to have had such a policy for so long. I'm embarrassed that it was there, and I'm just delighted that now we can embrace them as the comrades in arms that they are, and move forward and focus on more important issues.
On that level, as we're talking about the military, really like to know what your opinion is of Bradley Manning, his whistleblowing, and his court martial. Will you address that?
That's a contentious issue.
It sure is.
It's you know, certainly on one hand, he it would appear, you know, broke the rules and you know, released information that most assuredly in his role in the military he was not supposed to release. That said, you know, I can certainly see, you know, there being perhaps some good that could come from it. I am a big believer in transparency in general, but there's certain secrets that I think you know, state governments rightfully, you know, should protect, and you know, there's tension between you know, the amount of transparency that I'd like to see and the respect that should be given to, you know, a national government and its desire to protect some. So I'm conflicted with Mr. Bradley Manning on that.
Well, you know, Daniel Ellsberg became the Pentagon Papers are celebrated now. And, well, right now many people celebrate Bradley Manning. I'm one. I would ask you, too, if you would give me your take or your opinion of Mr. Julian Assange and his WikiLeaks. I fully know you're coming from a very tight background of being military, and you're running for Congress and being a part of our government. I think people like to know what you think of whistleblowing this new cyber-savvy, you know, whistleblowing organization that's out there to say enough with the secrecy in the world.
Right. So, again, you know, there's tension in my response with Julian Assange. Certainly, on one hand, I think he is doing some good. Where there, you know, are whistleblowers, they need legal protection where the whistleblowing is legal. And too often, whistleblowers, you know, have lost their job. They have been the subject of persecution. And whistleblowers, I have special sympathy for. And I know that they are taking risks with their reputation and in the organization that they serve. And almost every single time there's a whistleblower, that person has made a very difficult decision for all the right reasons, because that person is probably not going to benefit too much. And I know there are some laws in effect where whistleblowers can you know, profit from some of the improvement in some of the you know, some of the profit that might come from some whistleblowing tactics in, you know, corporations and the like. But my answer would be, where the whistleblowing is legal, I mean, absolutely, we need to have, you know, full protection, and we should applaud that type of activity. And not that this is a perfect segue, but, you know, I was reading in today's paper about the Secret Service manager that decided to take a great personal risk in blowing the whistle on the 19 Secret Service agents down in South America that had the tough read there from last week. And kudos to her for making that tough call. It was the right call to make, and our country would be in much better shape if we had more people that had the backbone to make those difficult kinds of decisions.
I agree with you 100% on that, Bruce. I would ask you, as far as it goes and what you've been discussing, there is definitely a humongous machine politically alive in this country called the Democratic Party. And I'm wondering how you fit into it, especially with your wedging your way into it. How would you go about making it more open and less of a mechanism for corporate interests? Do you follow where I'm going here?
I do. Well, I think that you'll agree with me that integrity is a core progressive value.
Yes.
And time and time again, too many incumbents, including my opponent, I think have compromised their integrity for their own advantage. And I think this is one of the key issues of our day, getting the corrupting influence of money out of government. And when we find congressmen that have sacrificed their honor and integrity and have clearly put out votes that have been influenced by money, there needs to be repercussions to that. And I have much more of a no tolerance for that type of shady behavior that I think is harming our country in dramatic ways. For instance, I don't know if you know much about the Joint Strike Fighter, but as a reasonable example of what's going on, my opponent voted for a redundant engine for this Joint Strike Fighter called the F-136. And it just makes no sense to do this. And the Pentagon desperately did not want this because, room is very scarce on an aircraft carrier. You don't have room for, two supply lines and two engines, and they perform in slightly different ways, and it just makes no sense. And the Pentagon didn't want it, nor did the military brass throughout the fleet. And so I look at this, I'm like, wow, why would Jim Moran, who I don't think is an aviation expert, make a decision like that, where for the last 50 years, no other aircraft other than the F-16 have had dual-sourced engines. And so I just take a couple minutes to look through research, and sure enough, there's five figures worth of campaign contributions from General Electric and Rolls-Royce, the maker of this alternative engine. And, I don't begrudge GE and Rolls-Royce for representing their special interests, but I do begrudge Jim Moran for not keeping them at arm's length. Those types of policies, if you multiply that by 435 and multiple times throughout the year, that is a huge distraction, that is a huge expense, and it is just corrosive to the ethics of government. We need to be focusing on the key issues of our day, not on this anti-democratic nonsense like this.
Well, what troubles and puzzles me, I mentioned I'm a big Tom Clancy fan, and I've read a lot of his well-researched fiction.
Yeah.
And, if politicians were put under the scrutiny that the intelligence community used to be put under, I wouldn't know what it is now in this country. Most politicians in this country, I'm thinking, would either be fined or in the hokey pokey.
I am sure you're correct. Just on that point, not to spend too long on my opponent here, but I remember where I was in 2002 when I read about him taking a massive sweetheart personal loan from MBNA, the big bank. And 4 days later, he co-sponsored legislation highly favorable to MBNA to make it harder for distressed citizens to declare bankruptcy, the very bankruptcy that Jim Moran avoided by taking the sweetheart loan. And when I read that in the Washington Post that they said he does not deserve the job because of that, I thought, well great, somebody's going to run against this guy and he's going to be voted out. He'll no longer be our dishonest congressman from this area. But no one ever did. And every other year, another scandal like this happened, and no one else decided to run. and I was just befuddled by the tolerance in our society for unethical congressmen to keep their jobs. And that's the kind of thing that needs to change. And to your earlier point about the Democratic Party and, you know, what we think we should do, well, I think we should clean our own house first. And we should be the party of honor and integrity. And if we're not going to do that, you know, bad things are going to happen. And we're not going to be able to turn the corner and address all the critical progressive issues of the day. This is an area, just because somebody might vote the right way more often than not, if they're not behaving in an honest and ethical way, they need to go. It's just that simple. And you can't find one organization in the world, Gwen, where the organization underneath an unethical leader is ethical. And, you know, an organization will only be as good as its foremost leaders. And that's, I think, partly why we have 90% public disapproval of Congress. I think they think the game is rigged. And it's highly frustrating that the public feels that they don't have, you know, the chance to correct this. And I'm delighted to give the you know, the folks here in the 8th Congressional District a choice, which they haven't had since 2004 in terms of you know, replacing this guy.
Well, I want to ask you, Bruce, why do you think that it's so hard to break through the patina, the nutshell of neglect or disinformation that keeps the people ignorant of all of the, you know, of course, I would say the mainstream media is certainly one of the number, it's no longer the fourth estate, it is a corporate machine that is working for producing consumerism, and consumerism includes your politicians now, and I would ask you if you know why people in general, is it just that folks don't have the time anymore to sit down and realize and read for themselves and educate themselves to the issues and to the facts, or is it because they aren't given the facts?
Yeah, it's interesting. I can't speak for too many other people, but I can let you know what I'm seeing on the campaign trail down here. And it's frustrating to meet some people that fancy themselves as having been very involved in politics here for the last 25 years or so, and many of them have no idea about some of the ethical transgressions that my opponent has had. And when they find out just about one or two of them, they're absolutely shocked. And it's interesting. So the Washington Post, you know, will talk about this on occasion, but they don't have it out there on a weekly basis, and they don't keep hammering that home. And even with PetitionGate here, it was just alarming how this was not front page news. I mean, how on earth can keeping a congressional candidate off the ballot through gross negligence or worse not be front page news in Northern Virginia for the Washington Post? But it wasn't.
Great.
And I get mentioned more often than not as the challenger. It's as if there's a conscientious effort to not give name recognition to me from some of the media sources here. And it's a little surprising, I have to say. So
I don't think there's any real surprise about it. To me, it's a symptom of the engulf and devour of corporatism in this country. But let me give myself a little bit of a break here in our conversation with that one by saying that, you know, never in my life did I think that there would be a day that I would come to question everything the government tells me. I no longer think everything I hear from my government is honest. And I never thought, and I come out of a family of politicians, and I campaigned for my Uncle Frank in upstate New York for years, and Frank Horton put the EPA together as a Republican using Republican and Democrat interns. That was the 70s, and whatever he had to push Nixon to get it done, he did it. That kind of politic has been bought now. And our government, it's hard to... Do you understand what I'm saying, Bruce? That's why little shows like mine are what we call alternative media, are the drum bangers now saying, you know, this is speaking truth to power. Do you follow where I'm going?
I do, and I would say that you know, the Daily Show and the Colbert Report can have, you know, surprisingly some of the best research of of media that's out there. It's disturbing that you know, a lot of the freest thinking doesn't seem to be done in our mainstream media nowadays. And fortunately, there are so many fantastic sources on the internet, and with shows like yours, Gwen, that you know, the truth can get out there.
Well, and there's loads of shows like mine, and there's also, we have really great resources that don't, people surprisingly have not, but they are beginning to get wise to. There's Link TV, there's Democracy Now. Amy Goodman deserves a halo to walk with, if you ask me. People will say, you know, well, I don't particularly like the commentary. And the truth is that Democracy Now! Never does commentary. It's only the facts that they report. It's just that people don't, they're so bowled over by it. That's incredible. How can that be true? She goes down and reports from Darfur on the climate change conference that we didn't even really attend down there. You know, we're talking about the health and well-being of a complete planet, and the United States has more important agendas for big energy and big oil. And, of course, you know, I'm coming from that liberal. What am I called now? I used to be called a liberal. Now I'm a leftist, almost a pinko commie now. The right has become so much part of the center place that it's hard to find the liberal left or the liberal Democrat anymore, what used to be. And I would ask you again about the environment. Do you have any, because I know we're winding up here, could you address that real quickly and then address any kind of point that you would like to make as a period to our conversation?
Sure. Well, one of my concerns with the environment right now would be certainly the need to have clean, safe, and renewable energy. And I think this is the, you know, technological challenge of the century. And to me, it seems to be so achievable. So many good things are going to happen when we get there, you know, with clean air, clean environment, lower health care bills, less defense spending, you know, to safeguard our energy needs. But I'm concerned about you know, one of the recent emphasis in terms of energy, you know, being fracking. And there's a lot we don't know about that, most assuredly. Yeah, I'm thinking that the flaming tap water probably is getting a lot of people's attention. Yeah, and I think the hazardous chemical spills probably do too. But there's so much unknown about, you know, the wastewater disposal wells. And I don't want to sound too alarmist here, but you know, you read about some of the increase in earthquakes around these fracking sites, and I think we're messing with Mother Nature a bit here, and you know, some bad things certainly happen. And there's a lot of very concerning chemicals being pumped into the earth, and you know, I'm hesitant after what happened in the Gulf and in many other areas to take the word of folks that have their bread buttered by this industry's emphasis on, you know, how this is safe and it's you know, perfectly regulated. I'm just not so sure. I take a jaundiced view of that, and want to make sure that before we go too much further, this is really being aggressively regulated before we have something again like what happened in the Gulf.
Well, yeah, I do have one more. I agree with you, Bruce, but the Gulf is my pet, you know, issue, getting the information out about that. We've got people in hospitals down here, over 11,000 cases of what we call Gulf sickness. Would ask you about the Super PAC, the campaign for primary accountability, and targeting and trying to maybe oust your opponent, Moran. Is that anything that you would ever, and this is a question from one of our folks in the chat room who is keeping an eye on all of this. You're getting quite a good listening ear here. So,
yeah, sure. On the campaign for primary accountability, I don't think it should be too surprising that they decided to target Jim Moran as being one and what they considered to be a corrupt congressman and vulnerable. That's exactly why I got into this race in the first place, because having lived here for 12 years, I haven't met two people that say that they enjoy voting for Jim Moran. What I hear disproportionately is that, well, I'm not particularly fond of Jim Moran, and I find a lot of elected officials that in public certainly wouldn't say anything negative about him. But in private, there's a lot of concern over what he's done over the last 22 years in office and some years before that as the mayor of Alexandria. Certainly there's no coordination. I have no contact whatsoever with the Campaign for Primary Accountability. I would only hope that they keep it to the facts, because they certainly don't need to do anything otherwise. There's certainly a lot of transgressions that he has committed in this area, and whatever they decide to do will be a complete surprise to me. That's for sure.
It seems like you're hitting at one Tammany Hall at a time here. there's certainly several of them out there to be kicked over. I really want to thank you for being gracious enough to answer some of my questions that a lot of candidates would have shied right away from. Thank you for doing that, Bruce. I appreciate it.
Well, Gwen, thank you so much for having me on, and look forward to next time.
Hey, and you're very welcome back. Is there anything that you would like to message out with here? We're at the top of the hour.
How important it is for people out there to have no tolerance for dishonesty in government and to hold your elected officials accountable. And when you see them coming up short, to make noise about it and to get involved and run for Congress when you see somebody that is coming up short, and don't let people stand in your way. It's tough. There's certainly a fun side of campaigning, but I'd encourage so many of the people that are articulate on politics and clearly have a zeal and ardor for moving things in the right direction as aggressively as possible, do the right thing and get involved, and your country will appreciate it, and the world will be a better place.
Bruce, thanks for being with us today. Much success with your campaign. We'll keep an eye on you, and hopefully we can get you to come back out and talk with us as the campaign goes on.
I would be delighted to. Thank you so much, Gwen.
You're welcome. So, ladies and gentlemen, that was hopefully Congressman Bruce Shuttleworth. He came on to speak with us today from a progressive point of view. I think he did a pretty good job of showing for himself. I'm a little bit, on the Navy side, though, guys. You know that, right? So we're going to play a little tune for you and come back and talk about Earth Day, and there's some Earth news out there, and there's also something Yes Men did this week that is really, really cool, and I want to talk about that. Maybe Krell or Anita will call in and help us get that done. So we're going to go to a tune right now, and I'm looking for it. A little bit of Graham Nash here.
White food.
Some Graham Nash. Hey, almost done. Written for Occupy, Occupy Wall Street. And again, I say, May Day is coming, and it's going to be a general strike. And everybody, just lay it down on May Day. If you wanted to go a Maine, do it this way. Get out there and occupy nature. Or better yet, as I said before, go on down to your local Occupy group. Oh, and do yourself some marching. And I say, screw this NDAA stuff. Listen, I'll tell you what. That was Mr. Bruce Shuttleworth. Thank him for giving us an opportunity to ask him some questions today. He is the progressive Democrat who's running against the corporatist machine in Northern Virginia. And I have to give it to him. He was because he's really rather traditional politician, and he honestly and openly did his very best to answer some questions that, frankly, politicians run screaming from these days. And he pretty well knows that the MSM is trying to just sell a product, and it's pretty tough to get your face out there unless you're playing the game, and he apparently isn't doing it so they don't pay attention to him. But we are, and we thank him very much for being with us today. And I have, is that you, Anita, on the phone?
That's me.
Hey, so I give kudos to Bruce Shuttleworth for coming on and being with us and what he had to say. You know,
I think he did a great job, actually. I thought he was very good, and he's very direct when he answers the questions, and it was good to hear from him.
Yeah, instead of having Diane, she's not a good representation. Instead of having George Stephanopoulos walk all over him, you know, ask a question and walk all over his answer, he gets to say something, and he gets asked questions that are more pertinent to people who consider themselves better informed, because he did address to the best of his ability with those, and I give him kudos for it. You know what? We got a friend on Facebook who wrote something the other day that I really think comes to bear about responsibility. His name is Joe Timperio. He hangs out over at the Wild Left, and he said that human beings do not derive rights from external sources. They are intrinsic, given our existence, and justified by the evolutionary nature of our origins. They do not come from supernatural agents such as gods or corporeal masters such as governments. In fact, contrary to popular belief of some people, the only thing that gods or governments can do is suppress these rights individually, collectively, or in extreme cases, completely. And I think he makes a pretty good case for responsibility for ourselves, don't you?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, with that kind of thing,
That was very good, actually.
Yeah, with that kind of thinking going on out there, I get hopeful again. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I think that the tide is turning. I really think that 2012 is not necessarily a bad time, but it is a time of a reawakening, and I think that's what's happening. I really do.
Well, I would agree with you, but that's the medicine woman in me telling you that one. And I expect it doesn't mean that it's going to be easy. There's a lot of darkness out there to get through, that's for certain. And, you know, the lousy captains have still got their hands on the helm, if you ask me, and I know you agree with that one. Let's face it, we don't have any faith or security in our government anymore. The politicians they're just, most politicians are obvious opportunists for corporate money. Bruce does not sound at all like that. And as far as it goes with what there is to know about him, he isn't like that. So the quagmire that is D.C. and corruption, if progressive Democrats or progressives and independents who are integritous and looking to make a change are out there, we need to support them. I'm not one of the folks who's going to say that this ism or ology or ocracy is definitely a way we have to go and that's it. And what is it? Just there's only one way down the road and that's to, you know, take it all up. No, we have to do what we can to work with what we've got and to keep fighting the good fight on all the fronts that we believe in.
Right, right.
At least I think so.
But have you been keeping up with what's been going on in regards to the anniversary of the Gulf Oil Gusher? Because there was quite a lot of information that came out over the past couple days.
There has been, and I'm glad you called in because I'm going to absolutely hand you the carpeting there and say, hey, listen, what's up, pup?
Okay, well, I blogged a few things on Hoodooed, and in fact, there were so many articles that came out and media pieces. It was the first thing that was pretty revolutionary was a study that was done by a gentleman out of USF. His name was, I believe, James Kirby. Let me check on that. I'm looking at the story now. You can see it at Hoodooed. That's hoodooed.blogspot.com. The study was equivalent to a peer review, and what it showed was people that were actually going and swimming in the water and coming out and being hit with the ultraviolet light, and there was presence of dispersants, of course, mixed with the crude on their skin. Now, for people that think that this is okay, it's cool, you know, you could just wash it off. This stuff doesn't wash off. The study goes into quite a lot of detail, and really, for me, it's just way over my head as far as scientific goes, but I was able to scan and glean a lot of information from the study. It does have some photos that were taken of the test subject and then with the test subject without the ultraviolet and then the test subject with it. I also included a video that was done by a woman who's an independent researcher in the upper panhandle of Florida. And this stuff does not wash off. It is absorbed into the skin and it becomes a part of your DNA. And that is one of the reasons why people are getting sick in the Gulf. The person who did the study is James H. Rip Kirby III. The study was done under the Surfrider organization, the Surfrider Foundation, which are a very well-known nonprofit. And anybody who wants to read it, the link to the PDF file is on the blog. Hoodooed.blogspot.com. If you're still swimming and if you're still eating seafood in the Gulf of Mexico, beware because it is not safe. The next thing that came out, did you see this by any chance, the Al Jazeera English report, Gwen?
No.
Okay, this was a report that was done with the very well-known author Dar Jamal with Dr. Ricky Ott. There was a lobbyist on this particular interview. It was a panel with Ricky Ott and the lobbyist and Dar Jamal being televised in. And the interviewer is with Al Jazeera English, but of course I can't remember his name. But it was a really well-done interview. Dr. Ricky Ott was able to speak about the illness that has afflicted many in the Gulf region. She did talk about seafood safety, as did Dar Jamal, and the lobbyist came just totally unprepared. So it would be interesting for anybody to watch that. That's also linked on Hoodooed. The next story was an expose done by the famous author and investigative reporter Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T. And his story was titled BP Covered Up Blowout 2 years prior to deadly Deepwater Horizon spill.
That I did see.
Yeah, so we are looking, that's included with the video. There's a part one and a part two. There's a link to get to the whole study or story on echowatch.org is where it was published. But there was a blowout, and it was off the Caspian Sea, and it was before the BP blowout. BP had ample time to correct the mistakes that caused the problems in the Caspian Sea, and they did not. And as a result, the point that Greg Palast was making is that BP did not have to, the BP in the Gulf did not have to happen.
Yeah.
So that was a big article. And then Dr. Ricky Ott did another story, which was put on Huffington Post, which was titled Making It Right After BP Oil Disaster Is Up to Us, Not BP. So that was the title by Dr. Ricky Ott. That's R-I-K-I, last name O-T-T. And the other one was by Dr. Tom Termato, a second anniversary report on the BP Gulf oil spill. Deepwater Unknowns 2 years later. So there's quite a lot of reading there. I haven't finished all of it myself because I've been so overwhelmed just with work. But in any case, I encourage everybody to go to the blog and read and research. And if you have any questions, put some comments there, and then we'll see if we can answer them for you.
Definitely. There were three stories not told on Earth Day. The first one, and I get this at Media Matters, the first one is the garbage in the ocean that's accumulating rapidly. And I'm just going to go through with this. It said, did you know that the middle of the Pacific Ocean, there's a garbage strewn across twice the size of Texas? In 1997, oceanographer Charles Moore discovered what is now known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a whirlpool of debris and storm drains and fishing boats, which includes plastic bottles, light bulbs, toothbrushes, boxes, abandoned fishing nets. It's quite extensive. The debris is widely dispersed, making cleanup an enormous challenge. It's like the floating Sargasso that used to steal boats 2,000 years ago. Much of the plastic that's been accumulated there is broken down into small pieces, which seabirds ingest, and then as they mistake it for food, the plastic is not only toxic for marine life, it eventually contaminates the human food supply.
Well, the plastic is, people don't realize, plastic is a byproduct of the petrochemical industry. And, you know, when plastic enters into our environment, it does not break down naturally. It doesn't break down in anything. It's just there forever until it ends up in little pieces. And once it's in your body, it's, it, again, becomes part of your DNA.
Right.
So.
Well, the scientists say that this floating landfill has grown significantly in recent years and will continue to get larger as 1 to 2 million tons of debris from the 2011 tsunami in Japan, which is global, our fancy new global debris, makes its way into the North Pacific's rotating ocean current. This is not only one of a kind. Similar garbage patch has been found over here on our side in the Atlantic. as there have been now several others across the ocean. Nobody mentioned this today on Earth Day. The second story, of course, is that at least 46 oil spills have occurred in the U.S. since the BP disaster. Can we go over that one again?
46
motherfucking oil spills since the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. 5 million barrels of oil poured out of the Gulf of Mexico in the wake of BP's Deepwater Horizon disaster. Nonstop media coverage drew national attention to the safety and environmental risks posed by deepwater oil drilling. But once the well was capped, the media quickly moved on, motherfuckers. Congressional safety reform measures floundered. Floundered. That was the word that Media Matters could find for it. Floundered. And the lessons of the largest oil spill in history were largely forgotten. Thank you, President Obama. Public outrage has subsided because nobody knows or is talking about it. But the risk of oil spills has not. In 2 years since the BP disaster, at least 46 oil spills have occurred around, across the U.S. According to the NOAA data compiled by Blue Planet Water Solutions, and we know that there's a little corruption going on there, too, so if only 46 are being reported, Anita, good grief, in the absence of meaningful action by Congress, may I say that again, in the absence of any meaningful action by Congress, oil spills will continue to threaten ecosystems and disrupt the tourism and seafood industries. Disrupt them? What motherfucking tourism and seafood industry is there in the Gulf that isn't deadly? Can you please explain that to me?
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Nevertheless, mainstream media has neglected to report on these ongoing risks. MSNBC, thank you very much, has delightful commercials about going down and spending your vacation at the Gulf and swimming and eating there. And BP has cleaned up all of its mess. My God. Meanwhile, the conservative...
Oh, yeah, let's not forget that, you know, Iris, whatever her name is, Iris Cross, she's the black woman with the short bobbed hair to her neckline.
Yeah.
That comes on and tells us that the water's fine and the seafood is great and come down and vacation. And BP made it right. Iris Cross, we call her the BP lady here.
You ought to call her the Medusa of the Gulf.
The BP Gulf. Liar. Actually, Medusa was a lot kinder than Iris Cross.
Jesus.
You know, I mean, you gotta look at that from that point of view, because this is really very scary. Very scary.
Well, here's another really frigging scary piece of news, too, that people should know. It's close to the shorelines from Texas down through down along Louisiana. The Gulf of Mexico contains a dead zone, devoid of life the size of New Jersey. A 2008 study by ecologist Robert Diaz of the Virginia Institute of Marine Science found that there are more than 400 dead zones in coastal waters across the world, totaling 95,000 square miles. Many of these are hypoxic zones caused by nitrogen pollution from farms and sewage runoff, which contributes to the excessive algae blooms that deplete oxygen in the water and kill and drive away marine life. Can I say here that this is why all of the dead fish comes pouring ashore, you know? And we have all these freakos that'll say, you know, hey, it's biblically being a sign of the seventh seal or whatever. You know where I'm going with that crap.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that pollution from the Mississippi River washed watershed contributes to massive reoccurring dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, and now it's being inwashed with the Corexit and crude, which was, I mean, we have got ourselves more than just dead zones. We've got ongoing poison being, you know, just ensconced and crawling up the Mississippi River into the watersheds, the water tables of Middle America up towards Canada. And people are still wanting to drill, and our president would like to, he says one thing one day and another day, but you can bet your last dime that this guy is going to stand up and say for a vote where he has to that XL Pipeline is a coming on through.
Hmm.
I mean, that's basically who's who with the whole thing, you know. It's energy companies and war makers and energy and corporate consumerism. That's the main.
Well, see, this is just it. I have an issue with us slapping each other and judging each other for using fossil fuels because we don't have choices.
No, we don't.
I mean, people, so I'm not going to make myself guilty because I've got to get in my car and go to work and spend gas. I am not the guilty party. But
and you're actively working to find, to establish alternative resources. You know,
exactly.
But
for me, for people to come online and then judge me because I have to use my car, well, you know, I say this to them. Look, there is no public transportation. I can't ride a bike 35 miles to get to work. You know, it's not possible. So these are choices that, you know, if I was living in an urban center, I might have to rethink and find an alternative way to do things. But as long as I'm living where I'm living, and then I've had people actually judge me and say, well, you need to move into the city then. And I say, no, I don't. You know, I moved out in the country so I'd maintain some sense of safety by being out here because I didn't think being in the city was safe anymore. I was not living in a safe environment.
I can certainly see your point. Well, we're coming to the last 5 minutes of the show, and I'd really like to get one thing in here. Mike Stimson, our Mike Stimson over at Roundtree 7, said something which I find pretty potent for Earth Day. He said, everyone wants Earth Day observances to include calling politicians disturbingly anti-Earth positions and statements, calling them for it. Canada's Prime Minister, and Mike is from Winnipeg, Canada's Prime Minister has called the Kyoto Protocol a socialist scheme, and his government has made Canada the first nation to withdraw from Kyoto. In the United States, the president has signaled that he'll reverse his Keystone XL decision, and his GOP opponent is against taking measures to reduce carbon emissions. Instead of only Pollyannish celebrations, the day must include putting these guys on notice. So I think what Mike is suggesting is that just as we have just done, Anita, bitch and scream, make your voice heard, get in the streets. That's truth to power, you know?
Right, right. Exactly. We
want
can't
to
be silent anymore.
There you go. I want to thank you so much for coming on and giving me some information on this Earth Day. I want to congratulate again our friends in New Orleans who completed the Soul Fire for the Gulf ceremonies, and we're getting rain we much needed. So I'd say
their mojo worked over here because
I'd say there's no screwing with Dr. John and 13 Indigenous grandmothers. You know.
Let me tell you something. Flash had her own. Flash Silvermoon had her own drum circle up by Gainesville in Melrose, so she had that on Friday night. I wasn't able to attend.
We had one here, too. There were several satellites. and across the country, and one on almost every continent, too, that aligned with it.
So I think the mojo worked. I mean, we were at the point where I was stepping on the grass, and it was crunchy. It was literally, like, crunching, like desertification had stepped in, and, you know, the grass was going to disappear if we had one more week of dryness. But, you know, so it worked. And maybe this is what we need to do is develop a network and just do these mojo all at the same time.
It's definitely part of what we need to do. Ceremony for the earth and at sacred sites is got to become one of our number one our number one goals. Thanks, Anita, for being on. I'm going to play us off. And everybody, please return tomorrow evening for Wise Woman Media with Anita Stewart at 8 p.m.
Okay, I'll see you all on the radio. Y'all have a good night. Bye.
Twenty secure phones to assist in staying anonymous? $5,000. Fighting legal cases across 5 countries? $1,000,000. Upkeep of servers in over 40 countries? $200,000. Donations lost due to banking blockade? $15,000,000. Added cost due to house arrest? $500,000. Watching the world change as a result of your work? Priceless. There are some people who don't like change. For everyone else, there's WikiLeaks. To find out more about WikiLeaks financial blockade and how to donate, please visit wikileaks.org/support.html.
This has been Here Be Monsters, the Sunday show. Please go on over and listen to Rick Spezak at Progressive News Network. We'll be with you again next Sunday with Jack Jodell back with us. Thanks a lot. Now, y'all be safe and clear out there.